The next presentation was given by Dr. Philip from the Karmanis Cancer Center in Detroit on the use of PARP inhibitors in the management of pancreatic cancer.
What I'm going to do today is talk about pancreatic cancer, but with a special focus on DNA repair and the PARP inhibitors. One of the things which has happened is that a lot of work has been done on the molecular level to see what is really the pancreatic cancer, what drives pancreatic cancer, what maintains pancreatic cancer, and really what is the reason why some drugs are active and others aren't, and why do you get resistant to treatment. So that science has really improved significantly over the last 10-15 years. But obviously for today, I'm not going to talk about everything. I'm just going to focus on one aspect of it, one aspect of the biology of pancreatic cancer, which is DNA repair. It's estimated that 12-15% of the patients have some form of DNA repair abnormality. And that by itself can be utilized for treatments that are specific for that sort of molecular change that happens in the tumors. And the one which is really most studied at this time is BRCA1 and 2 mutations. So all of you are familiar with the concept of synthetic lethality, which we see in patients or tumors that have either BRCA1 or 2 mutations, where you can induce lethality in the cell, in the cancer cell, by using a drug, in this case will be a PARP inhibitor. And the nice thing about this is that although all cells in the body will have the BRCA1 or 2 mutations, that particular lethality is going to be specific to the cancer cells. So this is something that's really very important, but at the same time, with so many drugs available and all the information we have on other cancers like breast and prostate cancer, so most of you know the biology very well. But just to remind you that it's the concept of systemic lethality taking into our advantage. So there are a number of drugs that are currently been tested, some of them in the market. But something you have to be aware of is that the PARP inhibition is really something which has been attacked by a number of drugs, but the potency of these drugs and the effectiveness of these drugs and the therapeutic index of these drugs is not the same. I would like to show you the slide showing that, for example, olaparib, rucaparib, in terms of their potency, they are more active than talaparib, which was the earlier drug that was being tested in patients. So this is just to give you an idea that the PARP inhibition is not equal to all the drugs that we have at this time. Now, what about the BRCA1 and 2 mutations? How often do we see them? Certainly, there's some variation depending on ethnic background in terms of, for example, United States, where the patients are. However, I would say on average, we see it in 5 to 7% of the patients who will have BRCA1 or 2 mutations. And I can tell you now that the BRCA2 mutations are seen more frequently than the BRCA1 mutations in those patients. And of course, here I'm referring to germline mutations. However, there's also a question on whether the BRCA1 or 2 mutations in the tumor itself without having a germline background, is that also going to be similar when we come to biology or phenotype? As you well know, NCCN guidelines clearly indicate that newly diagnosed patients with pancreatic cancer must be considered for germline testing. And the reason for that is that studies have shown that in patients who have BRCA1 or 2 mutations, they don't necessarily have to have a family history. And therefore, you shouldn't be waiting for someone who has family history of breast cancer, ovarian, or pancreatic, or prostate to really go after the testing. You have to do it on all patients who are newly diagnosed. So this is something which has now become, or is becoming increasingly part of our standard of care in the management of pancreatic cancer. Now, I just want to talk about the pivotal trial, which is POLO. And this was a phase 3 trial, which included many countries. And this was a study that randomized patients to receive olaparib 300 milligrams daily versus placebo. Now, the key thing here to remember is that, number one, this was in patients who have germline mutation. Number two, patients should have received platinum-based treatment for at least 4 months. But not only that, they should have had either response to the platinum compound or stable disease. And of course, the other things in relation to performance status being 0-1, all patients had metastatic disease. And ultimately, after screening for more than 3,000 patients, they ended up randomizing 154 patients who were positive for the germline mutation. Just to give you a very, very brief idea of the type of the patients who went on the study, you can see that the median age was 57. So that's younger than what we see in other trials we've gone through, which also goes back to the BRCA1 and 2 mutations that can happen in a bit of younger patients. They don't have to be very young, by the way, but a bit younger than the patients we see on average. As I mentioned, most of the patients had BRCA2 mutations, and the treatment they received, although they could have received any platinum-based treatment, but in fact, they were mostly received FOLFIRINOX, as you would expect, but there were also some patients who received gemcitabine and cisplatin. And in terms of the response to the chemotherapy, which they had at the time they were enrolled into the study, was approximately 50%. Now, you may argue and say they might even see a better response rate, but this is, again, at the time point of 4 months or so. I'll come back to that in one of the studies that I'm going to also focus on with gemcitabine and cisplatin. Now, when you look at the primary endpoint of the trial, which was progression-free survival, there was a very nice separation of the curves. You can see here that the patients who had the olaparib did much better than patients who received only placebo, or in other words, less supportive care only. So there was a significant improvement, and you can see that that continued for the duration of the follow-up, and the median progression-free survival was over 7 months versus less than 4 months. So certainly a study that was positive, and this really led to the approval of the FDA of olaparib almost 10 months ago as a treatment in the maintenance after response or stability to platinum-based treatment. Now, since the study was published, people went back and looked at different aspects of the trial that will give us some useful information about how good this treatment can be in terms of different subgroups of patients. But one of the things which really people wanted to look at was, how does it really affect the different types of mutations? So when we say BRCA1 or 2 mutations, there are different types of mutations involving different parts of the gene. And in fact, this treatment worked in all these different mutations patients had. So as long as the patient has a germline mutation that's validated to be a mutation that affects the function of the gene, this treatment is really working. Very simple. And then people looked at subgroup analyses, and you can see that in this initial look, which was part of the initial study, in fact, almost all the subgroups had a favorable response to the treatment. So there wasn't really a clinical or pathological criteria that will tell us a patient is not going to respond or respond. In fact, the response was across all the subgroups. And they went back and did another analysis more recently, which was presented in ESMO. Again, the same conclusion that if you look at the subgroup analyses here, you can see that almost all of them had benefit from the treatment compared to the placebo. Now, one of the interesting things which I find here is that patients who had olaparib, they had not only better progression-free survival, but also they continued to respond to the treatment. So the carryover of response and augmentation of the response continued even after they stopped the chemotherapy and they continued on taking the oral pill, the olaparib, compared to, again, the patients who received the placebo. And the median duration of response was also longer. And also, interestingly, patients had longer median time to onset of the response. So certainly, one would consider this as something which is the biology of the disease also changing favorably to allow patients to respond longer, if you would, on the platinum treatment. Looking at other aspects of the disease progression, so basically, this is looking at time to second progression. So after the first progression, when they were put back on chemotherapy, could be any chemotherapy that was appropriate for the patient. But when you look at the time for the progression the second time, after obviously they've been off the olaparib, again, the biology appears to be different because it's favoring patients who had received olaparib in terms of the time to their second progression. Again, something which is really interesting to see. So it goes a bit more than just maintenance. It's just doing something to the disease that's also changing its biology. When they looked at the overall survival, they did not see a difference. And this was something which is intriguing, because why do you see that improvement in other parameters I just showed you, whereas when it comes to the overall survival, we're not seeing a difference? At this point in time, it's difficult to explain. Part of it is the maturity of the data, and also the possibility that patients who received the placebo may have ended up getting the olaparib, although when looking at those numbers, there are not really that many patients who did that, probably less than 20%. But certainly, this is something which is worth seeing what happens with time when we get more mature data. Now, one of the important questions that people ask is that, okay, so you're testing the drug versus a placebo. What's the type of patient experience in terms of side effects, in terms of quality of life? Now, certainly, testing a drug against placebo, you're going to see more side effects. And the side effects that we're seeing are within the range what you expect with olaparib. So basically, the fatigue, nausea, some of the GI symptoms. So you see those, and you're going to see them because you're treating the patient with active treatment compared to the placebo. And what about the rate of the interruptions in terms of dose reductions? So if you look at, I'm going to start with the median duration of treatment. So that's almost double. So it means that the treatment was working. But if you look at any toxicity, and if you look at grade 3 or more side effects, certainly there's more in the patients who received the olaparib. Interruptions, a third of the patients undergo interruptions. But the rate of the discontinuation was certainly less than 10%. In fact, it was 5.5%. So an important measure in terms of putting someone on a maintenance treatment, can you really maintain them? So certainly there were patients who were discontinued, but that was really a low number because the treatment was managed with interruption of restarting treatment and also by dose reduction. So this is another study which was presented in ASCO GI and in fact was published. And in this trial, they showed that the quality of life in fact was well-preserved and in fact better than what was seen in patients who had the placebo. So this was really an important aspect of our thinking of, does this type of treatment with side effects, especially when compared to placebo, does it really make patients worse? In fact, according to this, probably not. You don't see that happening. And then there was another analysis which was presented in ASCO in 2020, looking at, again, analysis of TWIST, which is, as you know, it's a well-known way of looking at how the treatment affects the patient's quality of life in terms of the survival. And there was superiority in patients who had the treatment with olaparib compared to the placebo. So that was the POLO trial. Now, the question becomes, in the POLO trial, patients were not really heavily pretreated. What about patients who are heavily pretreated and they get olaparib single agent? And this was a study based on the TAPER registry. And in this trial, they had 28 patients who had received olaparib. They were heavily pretreated. And you can see that there is a response rate of 7% and disease control rate of 1/3 of the patients had disease control rate, and the 1-year overall survival was close to 50%. So there is a benefit also in patients who have been heavily treated. It is a single agent activity of olaparib. Regorafenib is another drug which has also been tested as a monotherapy in patients who have BRCA mutations. I'm not sure whether this drug is being further developed in this disease. I just want to show you this so that you know that there is also another possibility, but this drug is not approved by FDA, so we're not using it. And as I said, I'm not sure what's going to happen with this drug. Again, there's another study which deals with the same drug, rucaparib, but the reason why I'm showing you this slide is simple, because in this study, they also showed that patients can respond to a PARP inhibitor with a somatic mutation. So it's not only the germline mutation, maybe that's going to drive us to use these medications, but certainly, if someone has a somatic mutation, you do the NGS and the patient has BRCA1 or 2 mutation, it looks like those patients will also respond to the treatment or have a chance of responding to the treatment. Again, the quality of response may be different. I don't know. No one has done a randomized trial and no one will do, but certainly something to keep in mind. So what happens in the future development of these agents? This is a study that has been approved to start. And at this point in time, this PARP inhibitor, again, going back to rucaparib, is going to be probably replaced by olaparib for logistic and other reasons to do with sponsor. And this study is looking at patients who have resected pancreatic cancer. They go on adjuvant treatment, in this case, FOLFIRINOX, and after the 6 months, they get randomized to receive the PARP inhibitor versus a placebo. So this is looking at the use of maintenance treatment in the earlier stage disease, which makes a lot of sense to try to improve the outcome of those patients who have undergone surgical resection. There's another area of active research in the use of PARP inhibitors. And one of them is that the treatment of tumors with a PARP inhibitor, this is preclinical data showing that if you do that, then there is an increase in the PD-L1 expression. So that's something which is being, for us in pancreas cancer, where we didn't do that well with immunotherapy, that's something which we'd like to see improvement in our ability to use immunotherapy. So the bottom line is that with PARP inhibitors, you increase the expression of PD-L1. Therefore, that gives an opportunity to test the addition of a immune checkpoint inhibitor to the PARP inhibitor. Sure enough, the GI steering committee recently approved that trial, and this study is going to start hopefully within the next few weeks. This is looking at patients with, again, metastatic disease who have germline mutations in either BRCA1 or 2, and the patients will be undergoing, again, chemotherapy with a platinum-based treatment for at least 4 months. They respond or stable disease. They'll be randomized to receive olaparib, so that's the POLO trial, versus olaparib plus pembrolizumab. As I mentioned, this study is going to start hopefully within the next few weeks. It will accrue just under 100 patients, so it will be interesting to see what happens. Now, I just want to circle back to the issue of the induction treatment with a platinum compound. So, as you know, gemcitabine cisplatin was a combination that was developed like close to 20 years ago, but we never got into using it because the phase 3 trial didn't really show benefit. And then, fast forward, we got FOLFIRINOX, a platinum-based treatment. Now, we're going back to gemcitabine cisplatin as an alternative to FOLFIRINOX in patients who have BRCA1/2 mutation. Dr. O'Reilly recently published this article using gemcitabine cisplatin plus minus veliparib. Now, veliparib wasn't active. He didn't add anything, added maybe toxicity. But gemcitabine cisplatin really gave us a very interesting response rate. So in patients with BRCA1/2 mutations, cisplatin gemcitabine is an option for the patient. And in fact, it's an option, especially in patients who may have not so good liver function because you're not using a drug cleared by the liver. In FOLFIRINOX, you have the irinotecan. Here, you don't have that. So again, something to keep in mind. A recent panel, which I was part of, we looked at what is the new thing in metastatic pancreatic cancer. Again, I don't want to go into details of this article, which was recently published. It's now establishes targeting BRCA1 and 2 with olaparib as one treatment option for patients who have BRCA1/2 mutations. In fact, this article leads us to one important point, which is when do we test, what do we test in terms of molecular profiling, something which wasn't being done in patients with pancreatic cancer. It's something really new for us. So this leads me to really putting the overall picture, the way at least I practice. So in my practice, I need to get the BRCA1/2 mutation testing soon and early. And there are ways you can do that. And you can do it in the blood, you can do it in the tumor itself, because that helps me to decide on the frontline treatment. Now, if you're going to use a platinum-based treatment, fine. Maybe you're not really that much stressed for time to get the test done. But certainly for the frontline treatment, you need to get some idea about the BRCA1/2 mutation. Now, I also put here PALB2 mutation because there's also indication or suggestion that PALB2 germline mutations may also respond to olaparib-like drugs. So that's something which I put it there. Now, once you're past your first line and you go to the second line, you will need other molecular information. Unfortunately, you have a very narrow field there, but fortunately, it's expanding with some several interesting drugs. And the key thing in the second line would be, or beyond the first line, is to see whether someone has MSI high or stable. And the MSI high is only 1-2%. But in patients who have KRAS wild type, which represents 10% or so of the patients, there's an increasing list of targets that you can use for using new generation treatments that we have. And more recently, I'm sure you heard that the KRAS mutation G12C tested mainly, or there's evidence in colorectal and lung cancer, these mutations, now there's a drug which targets that mutation. And again, when you come to other mutations like NTRK fusion, NRG1, HER2, BRAF, and others, so that's really in the space of the KRAS wild type. Now, certainly KRAS mutations are not routine like we do in colorectal cancer, but if you do it in patients with pancreas cancer, then you may end up having some interesting drugs that you can target those patients. And that's really something important, because patients who go after front line to second line, third line, that increases your ability to search for a drug for them. So just to conclude, platinum compounds and olaparib show activity in patients who have BRCA1/2 germline mutations, ask for FDA approval for the olaparib, but there is also indirect evidence that it may also help in patients that have only somatic mutations. And in pancreatic cancer, the first drug that has been approved based on a biomarker is olaparib. So that's something which hopefully we'll be expanding on. And again, there is a very clinically meaningful prolongation of progression-free survival, but at this point in time, we don't have evidence that the survival has been improved. And there are future directions in what we do in patients who have these mutations, adjuvant treatment, as maintenance treatment using olaparib, and also in combination with immunotherapy being tested. So at this point in time, you really have to think of the genetic profiling and genetic testing for the germline mutations in all patients you see. And again, please keep in mind that in patients who have wild-type KRAS, there's also an increasing list of targets that you can go after. With that, I'd like to thank you again very much.
All right, let's go through your cases. All right, so maybe you can present this 75-year-old man. What happened there?
So this is a 75-year-old male who's otherwise in good shape. He was presenting with abdominal bloating and some mild abdominal pain. He did have an ultrasound scan and then MRCP, which showed a pancreatic head mass, which measured approximately 3 centimeters. His CA19-9 was over 1,000. And his performance status was bordering on a 2. It's 1 to 2. And his past medical history had left nephrectomy for RCC, rheumatoid arthritis, and benign prostatic hypertrophy. So in our tumor board, we said, okay, we looked over things, and the surgeon wasn't so sure. I think coupled with probably his performance status, we decided not a surgical candidate, but we thought that he can take the modified FOLFIRINOX that he wanted to do. And at this point in time, we also did the NGS, and he had somatic BRCA1 mutation. And subsequent to that, actually, we did the blood test. He also had germline mutation. He had an Ashkenazi Jewish heritage. So this patient had a very good response to the treatment. As you can see, his CA19-9 went way down. And we had some issues with him. He had the fatigue, grade 3, diarrhea, grade 2, neuropathy, grade 1. And then this patient, we switched earlier. So we didn't wait for the 8 cycles like the Polo. After 6 cycles, we said, let's give him olaparib that he wanted to be on maintenance treatment. And he now continues on it for 5 months plus. And it's obviously his fatigue, diarrhea, all improved. So this is a good example of someone who you can now switch them to a treatment maybe even earlier, although that's not the way the Polo trial was done. But certainly it gives an opportunity for a patient to be on an active treatment, which is more targeted therapy.
Let me just clarify. He has localized disease, right?
It was read as bone marrow resectable to locally advanced. So it was localized, yes.
But he doesn't have mets.
So, no, he didn't have mets.
I guess. No. So my question is, normally, would you integrate radiation therapy into the treatment of a patient like that?
It's possible that we may even do radiation in this guy. But he was, he's one of those people who told us, what happens if I heard about the drug? His daughter-in-law works in one of the drug companies. And, you know, we said, we'll go ahead with this. We don't have to do radiation, but we would do radiation more in patients who we see that the disease is stable for at least 4 or 5 months, just to tell us the test of the time that the patient is not going to develop metastatic disease.
So let me ask you, do you think that most GI oncologists, the investigators, would do what you did in this case?
Again, this is a unique case because the patient, we put him on FOLFIRINOX, had side effects, and we felt that we may need to move earlier to give him the other drug, the olaparib, than waiting another 4 weeks. This is just tailoring the treatment for a patient's needs. I mean, that's the way it best worked for this patient. Now, the issue of the radiation treatment is interesting, what you say, because is radiation a possibility in this patient? Yeah, of course it's a possibility. And I'm not sure if I'm not really even going to give him the radiation. The only thing is that normally I wait when I give chemotherapy for example, locally advanced disease or even borderline resectable, I wait a good number of months just to make sure that they're fine. In this patient, I'm seeing him being stabilized by a pill of olaparib. Radiation is not going to prolong his survival. We know that. None of the radiation so far, which is given either in the borderline resectable or locally advanced, has shown to prolong survival. If I'm going to control his disease by this pill, I'll just continue with it. If he starts to show some disease progression there, then I can give him radiation therapy. And if he develops metastatic disease, then I'll be happy that I didn't give him radiation treatment.
Right. No, I was just curious whether most people would do that. So, again, I guess your thinking was probably he, even with a response, he still was not going to be resectable?
Correct.
So I guess if I were going to present this case in its most simple state, we would say you have this patient with a BRCA germline. They have unresectable disease. He's not really symptomatic from it. So you gave him chemotherapy, and he sort of maxed out on that in terms of starting to have complications. And then the question is, what do you do next? So I guess theoretically, you could do nothing. You could observe him. You could do what you did, which is to give him olaparib. I guess you could give him radiation therapy. I mean, I don't know what other options there might be. Do you think that most people would do what you did, or do you think there'd be some variation?
It would be variation. One of them would be the radiation treatment. One of it would be, why don't you just cut down on the chemotherapy and give him lower dose of chemo? In my opinion, I thought, why don't I try something which is targeted? So I have this patient with what appears to be localized pancreatic cancer who had a CA19 of over 1,000. CA19 over 1,000 always is a red flag for patients not really doing well on surgery, even if you think of it that way, even if they appear to be resectable. And in a patient like this, who in our tumor board we decided he's not going to be a good candidate for surgery, we gave him neoadjuvant chemotherapy in a sense, or induction chemotherapy, or just simply chemotherapy with FOLFIRINOX. We got a dose reduction because of his age. It was modified FOLFIRINOX. And then he had a very good response to the treatment in terms of the reduction in the CA19-9 level. And after the first, second treatment, he was developing all the side effects. He was developing the symptoms of, he had the diarrhea. The most important thing for him was the fatigue. And someone who's at his age living on his own in this era of COVID. So basically, the patient had several options here. Continuing with the same treatment was going to be very tough for us because of what we were seeing in him. He was not doing well. So we had options. So one option was for us to cut down on the chemotherapy and bring it down to maybe minus oxaliplatin, maybe minus oxaliplatin and irinotecan, and just give him 5-FU, or give him capecitabine single agent. So that was one option. The other option was for us to give him a break from the treatment because he wasn't feeling that well. The third option was, based on our knowledge of ability of the olaparib to prolong progression-free time, so why not try that agent? And he will be closely monitored, so we will know what's going on. The other option was to give him radiation treatment, but at that point in time, it was a bit early for me to decide on giving him radiation therapy because I normally like to see patients stable and not having disease progression or metastases before I decide on radiation treatment. Keeping in mind that radiation therapy, neither in locally advanced disease nor in more resectable disease, has shown evidence for prolonging survival. So with that in mind, I made the decision to go for olaparib, thinking that it's going to be an easier treatment on the patient, given everything which was going on with him.
Let's go to the next case.
So the next patient is a younger patient. He was 52 when he came to see me. He worked as a pediatric emergency room doctor. At the same time, his father was also undergoing chemotherapy for pancreatic cancer. He presented with painless jaundice, and he had weight loss of 15 pounds. He also had steatorrhea. The CAT scan showed a mass in the pancreas, but also he had multiple liver lesions. And ERCP failed in this patient, and therefore he had to have an external biliary drain. And then he had a CT-guided biopsy of the liver, which showed a moderately differentiated adenocarcinoma. At that point in time, his bilirubin was just over 10, with a CA19-9, which was over 500,000, with a high C-reactive protein. And his overall performance status was a 2 at best. And on your right, you can see the liver metastases and also the biliary drain that was put. So in a patient was like this, the decision was, what do you give him? Do you give him FOLFIRINOX? Because if I want to give him FOLFIRINOX, I have to wait a long time for his bilirubin to come down to under 3 and preferably under 2 to be safe. Do I give him FOLFOX without the irinotecan? Do I give him gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel and then also risk the issue of the liver dysfunction and the nab-paclitaxel? Or do I give him gemcitabine alone, which I would never do? Or I give him gemcitabine and cisplatin. Obviously, I decided to give him gemcitabine and cisplatin. This was a few years ago. We didn't have Eileen O'Reilly's data. So he had full doses of gemcitabine and cisplatin. He finished 6 treatments, and early on, there was normalization of the serum bilirubin. Could be combination of the drainage and chemotherapy. But the key thing is that his performance status became 0. And he was planning to go back to work, and he went to his honeymoon that was postponed because of his diagnosis. We did molecular profiling, and he had BRCA1 mutation, in addition to other mutations that we see in this disease. And he also had germline mutation, so we confirmed that. He did have an excellent response to his initial chemotherapy. You can see the scans. You can see the CA19-9 level. And then, as I said, he wanted to go back to work and try to normalize his life as much as possible. So we put him on olaparib. This was compassionate use of olaparib. He was in clinical trial, and this was way before FDA approved it. And then he continued on it for 10 months. And he tolerated relatively well. As I said, he continued to work full-time. And his imaging, say, 99, continued to be stable. But then he progressed after 10 months. When he progressed, I repeated the molecular profiling, but I couldn't find anything which was different than the original one. His PD-L1 expression was elevated this time, but again, it's hard for me to think that I can relate it definitely to the treatment with olaparib.
So if you kind of go back through that case, I guess the thing that was complicating the case that made it more difficult was his elevated bilirubin.
Correct. The bilirubin was elevated. I mean, if you were to wait until this case was a very difficult case because you couldn't do any RCP. In fact, he had more than one drain. He had 2 drains. And for you to wait until his bilirubin was going down to the point that you can give him FOLFIRINOX or gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel would have been a long wait. Maybe you'd have never been able to give him. So for that reason, he needed to start treatment quickly. And gemcitabine cisplatin was the way to go in this patient.
What do you think most people would do?
Well, I mean, I think what chemo you would give is really important in this patient because some people might give FOLFOX frontline, although Eileen O'Reilly's study clearly shows that gemcitabine cisplatin is really very good and is easier to give. In this patient, I don't think we even put a port when we started the treatment because we could start the treatment without having a port placed, so it was easy. So this is a patient who's young. He was otherwise healthy, but now his performance status is 2. And now he comes to me with metastatic pancreatic cancer, proven histologically, and he has a high bilirubin. We can't bring it down with ERCP. We have to do external drainage. In fact, even double drainage. We couldn't even do one. And he looked miserable. But this patient, to give him through one of the standard two treatments would be impossible because I can't give him iron intake and I can't give him that paclitaxel. So what do I do? I don't want him to get treatment when he's suboptimal, and therefore I wanted to start treatment quickly. I didn't have time to put a port on him, but I was ready to start chemotherapy with the high bilirubin. And I myself, my own experience has been that you can give gemcitabine with elevated bilirubin. Gemcitabine is not cleared by the liver. And cisplatin itself, a metal, doesn't go through the liver metabolism either. You need a good kidney for it. So I started off with gemcitabine and cisplatin. Without a port, started the treatment while he was feeling unwell. And that's where I was. And then after giving him several treatments, in fact, early on, he showed improvement. In subjectively, he felt much better. And he was gaining weight. So at that point in time, in a patient like this, who's also eager to normalize his life, what do I do? Do I continue with the chemotherapy? He has stage 4 disease. Do I continue with the chemotherapy with the gemcitabine cisplatin? Do I give him gemcitabine alone? Do I give him capecitabine maintenance? Do I switch him to something else? Or do I stop the treatment altogether, which something for him wasn't acceptable because he's a young guy, he has stage 4 disease. So the optimal treatment at that point in time was to give him a PARP inhibitor because I had him tested early on. That's the way I've been managing my patients for a long time. And with that in mind, I went to the company and asked for a compassionate use drug, and I got it because that was the time when the POLO trial was also, I think, underway or started. And that gave us a very good way of trying to manage this patient, to take him back to full-time employment.